Hello, and welcome to the History of the Copts, Episode 39, The Three Chapters Controversy. So last time, we ended around 541 AD with the ordination of Jacob Boradios and the formation of a separate Miaphysite church hierarchy. This was a blow to the underlying ideology of the Christian Empire. But what happened next is really what crippled the empire after Justinian. But before I get to the bad news of the Justinianic plague, I would like to take a brief detour to Nubia and modern-day Sudan, where Bopsi Dosius and Theodora collaborated and left a lasting legacy of evangelism. The story as told in the primary sources picks up right after the closing of the last pagan temple in Egypt, in the island of Philae, at the most southern point of Egypt. The temple there was primarily open to serve the Nubians south of Egypt as a part of a really old treaty with Diocletian. There was no stated reason in the sources on why Justinian closed the temple, but my personal feeling is that it could have been the bad optics of closing down the churches that we discussed last week, but still keeping the pagan temple open. At any rate, once the temple was closed, Bopsi Dosius, one of the priests in his entourage, later the first bishop of Nubia, knew that the area was ready for missionary activity after 300 plus years from natural exposure from Christianity in Egypt. The priest, who was in the capital, before going on his mission, sought the blessings and the assurances of safety from Theodora, who naturally supported the effort and promised resources and help. Justinian, for his part, upon hearing of the efforts, decided to send Chalcedonian envoys instead to the area to beat the Miaphysites. Theodora was not to be obstructed, so she sent a letter to the general in charge of the area, instructing him to make sure that the Miaphysite priest reached the Nubian first before Justinian's envoys. The general, in turn, either out of Miaphysite sympathies or practical concerns that Theodora's wrath might be worse of Justinian's, decided to help the Miaphysites. Thus, the Miaphysite missionaries arrived to the king of the area with gifts and baptismal robes, and explained to him the advantages of joining the Miaphysite camp. When Justinian's envoys eventually arrived, it was too late. The king and many of his subjects were already Miaphysite Christians, and they will stay so until the days of Salah ad-Din, the famous general of the Crusades, almost 700 years later. Thus, the whole Nile Valley, from its beginning in Ethiopia to its destination, the Mediterranean, was Christian. In the meantime, in a major port city, Pelusium, near modern-day Suez in Egypt, a curious disease appeared. It was what we now call the bubonic plague, a variant of the famous Black Death plague that occurred in Europe in the 14th century. From Pelusium, it spread throughout Egypt, and quickly to all the Mediterranean ports in the empire via the Egyptian grain ships. To describe the events, I'm going to quote Evagrius directly, one of our primary sources and an eyewitness who lost most of his family to the plague. Evagrius writes, "I will also describe the circumstances of the pestilence which commenced at this period, and has now prevailed and extended over the whole world for 52 years, a circumstance such as has never before been recorded. 2 years after the capture of Antioch by the Persians, it broke out. It took its rise from Ethiopia, as it is now reported, and made a circuit of the whole world in succession, leaving, as I suppose, no part of the human race unvisited by the disease. Some cities were so severely afflicted as to be altogether depopulated. The plague was a complication of diseases, for, in some cases, commencing in the head and rendering the eyes bloody and the face swollen, it descended into the throat and then destroyed the patient. In others, there was a flux of the bowels. In others, abscesses were formed, followed by violent fever, and the sufferer died at the end of 2 or 3 days, equally in position with the healthy of their mental and bodily powers. Others died in a state of delirium, and some by the breaking out of carbuncles. Cases occurred where persons who had been attacked once and twice and had recovered died by a subsequent seizure. Evagrius mostly got the facts right. Also, thanks to modern genetics, we now know that the disease probably started out in China rather than Ethiopia, and probably got to Egypt by the India-China maritime trading route, on an infected rat in one of the ships. There is also a curious climate change theory going around that attributes the disasters that befell the empire at this decade to a sudden cooling of the atmosphere due to a volcano eruption somewhere where the ash blocked the sun. It's a pretty intriguing theory, but that's not really why we're here. This plague, regardless of its origins and backstory, had some very serious implication for the empire fortunes. It is estimated that Constantinople lost 40% of its population, and the empire as a whole lost 25%. Egypt was one of the hardest hit places, as it was highly urbanized, and the plague hit the cities hardest. Naturally, as a consequence, the tax base of the whole empire was shrunk considerably. And the situation was really dire, as the empire was currently engaged in a war on 3 fronts. In North Africa, the native Berbers, as a nomadic people, did not really get affected by the plague, and thus rebellions against their new masters became a frequent occurrence. Sure, North Africa was conquered by the defeat of the Vandals, but with the nomadic rebellions, it was not really governed. Additionally, the war in Italy seemed to be stuck in an endless struggle where the peninsula was quickly being depopulated by war, plague, and worst of all, famine. On the Persian front, the plague actually helped a little bit, as the Persians were hit by it as well. Eventually, a semi-ceasefire would be agreed to, but it will take 5 years to put it into action. And still, it wouldn't really affect the empire proxies in the Arabian Peninsula or Georgia. The big picture here was that by the 540s AD, the empire was internally divided because of religion, depopulated because of the plague, and financially bankrupt after 2 decades of non-stop war. Even so, it would be another 100 years or so until the Arabs finally relieved the empire of most of its territory. The seeds were sown right at this moment. The population would never really recover. The finances would always be shaky, and the religious divisions would only get bigger. In Egypt, this was really a bad time to be in. After the plague decimated the cities, an abnormal Nile flood caused a serious famine, probably exacerbated by the lack of manpower or the whole cooling of the climate sink. And with the army scattered on 3 fronts, desert tribes were having a field day in raiding the monasteries, and it became almost impossible to have a monastery in the desert that was not protected by walls and a small garrison. That's when the desert monastery of St. Catherine in Mount Sinai gets built, as well as the monasteries of St. Anthony and St. Paul by the Red Sea. Now, to be clear, monks have always lived there since the time of St. Anthony. But this was the moment when they got actual monasteries with several buildings and a fortress-like walls. All of these disasters naturally had an impact on Justinian, who had personally gotten the plague but recovered after a lengthy sickness. The Justinian that emerged from the disasters of the 540s AD was a different man than the energetic master builder, lawgiver, emperor of the 530s AD. The post-plague Justinian was much more religious, a man who pursued the favor of God above all else. Now, as I said earlier, Justinian was always religious and had his own complicated opinion in theological matters. But the post-plague Justinian took it on a whole new level. This Justinian felt it much more important to impose those views than everybody else. If you remember back in episode 35, when I dropped the name of the Neo-Chalcedonian movement when discussing the Severus Patriarchy in Antioch, well, it was about this time when they came into prominence. To keep it simple, the Neo-Chalcedonians wanted to keep Chalcedon and its theology, but take out anything that contradicted the writing of Cyril. So, to them, it was Cyril first and then Chalcedon, which was slightly different from the mainstream Chalcedonians, where it was Chalcedon first and then Cyril, and in turn, a little bit more different than the Miaphysites, where Chalcedon from beginning to end was a mistake. But really, with the death of Severus, the Miaphysites retreated into their own quickly forming church, and the fault lines between the Neo-Chalcedonians and the Chalcedonians took central stage. In addition to their strongly pro-Cyril stand, the Neo-Chalcedonians also held Origen in really, really high regard. Remember Origen from all the way back in episode 6? So in the upcoming struggle, Origen really gets into it for no good reason other than being a person highly regarded by a particular faction. So Justinian, in his effort to win the favor of God, basically jumped from one obscure theological concept to another, with whoever was able to convince him of their truths at this particular moment. There would be no more organized, well-sought-out policy changes to achieve a certain political goal. No, this Justinian died with the plague. From now on, this is going to be a broken man grasping at the next shiny thing that promises him the truth, whatever that is. First, through the papal influence in Constantinople, about a year after the plague, Justinian condemned Origen in a minor edict directed to a specific group of Palestinian monks who formed the core of the Neo-Chalcedonians. Then, one of those monks, in the process of trying to reverse the edict about Origen, impressed Justinian and essentially became his religious advisor, replacing the papal influence. Now, one of the most outspoken critics of Origen was Theodore, the teacher of Nestorius. So, in a roundabout way, Justinian was convinced that the way to bring the Miaphysite back was to condemn the works of Theodore, and while he added, he may as well condemn the works of Theodoret and Ibas that criticized Cyril. The theory here was that discrediting Theodore would return Origen to a place of respect and maybe bring the Miaphysites back. But to the Palestinian monks advising Justinian, the whole thing was really about Origen, and returning the Miaphysites was basically a secondary issue, where he had to take it on to convince Justinian it was worth the effort, and probably more importantly, to get Theodora's approval. But for the Copts in Egypt, and the Miaphysites in general, they were basically completely out of this conversation. I seriously debated just not talking about it at all, since Pope Theodosius was never really involved, nor was Jacob Bardius. But I decided it is worth jumping into, as in the casual telling of this story, Justinian condemns the three chapters out of negotiation slash intrigue with the Miaphysites to bring them back, which is quite misleading. The closest thing to that was the discussions held early in Justinian's reign and the letter of the Syrian monks to him that we discussed 2 weeks ago. But even then, like I said in that episode, the three chapters was what Justinian got out of the letter, not necessarily what the letter said. And at best, it only formed a small part of what the Syrian monks really wanted it. This was the Chalcedonians fighting among themselves, and one faction using the argument of bringing back the Miaphysites to their advantage. The palace intrigue and the struggle between the Babel influence in Constantinople and the Palestinian monks finally came to a head in 544 AD, where Justinian took the side of the new Chalcedonians and published an edict condemning the three chapters. Now, this was a problem for the traditional Chalcedonians, as two of the three bishops condemned were explicitly declared Orthodox in Chalcedon. So, by Justinian unilaterally condemning them, he's undermining the whole council. Not to mention, it ultimately put the relationship between ruler and church into the test. And that relationship was quite different between the East and the West. The citizens in the East had no qualms about their emperor taking an active role in religious issues. After all, he is chosen by God to rule over them. But in the newly acquired West and North Africa, where they have lived under an Arian regime for a while now, a different relationship developed. An emperor telling them who's a heretic and who is not was a no-no. So, naturally, Justinian's edict was fought tooth and nail in North Africa, and to a lesser extent in Rome. As one North African bishop put it, only Christ is priest and king, which really meant Justinian is neither a priest or a king as far as their ecclesiastical affairs go. In Rome, Pope Vigilius, as I said last episode, was not really ready to die in any theological hell, three chapters or not. But complicating his stand was the strong feelings of his Western and North African bishops. He would like to make Justinian happy, but losing the support of the entire West was a big price to pay. So he pretty much dragged his feet on the matter, until, in one of those ups and downs in the war in Italy, things looked really bad for Rome. So, with some pushing from imperial officers, he took a ship and traveled to the capital. In there, after about a year of imperial pressure and back and forth excommunication between Vigilius and Menas, the Patriarch of Constantinople, Theodora intervened and got Vigilius' signature on the condemnation of the three chapters. This would not be really the end of it, more like the beginning. But it is where we will stop at this narrative. Theodora would die within a year, and Justinian will take even a sharper turn in trying to earn the favor of God. The Western bishops will keep fighting against the condemnation of the three chapters, eventually forcing Pope Vigilius to take back his signature. But then Justinian would double down and a whole new council would be arranged to settle the issue. The Second Council of Constantinople would eventually lead to the condemnation of the three chapters and, surprise, the condemnation of Origen, who the whole thing was started to defend his name in the first place. If I do it right, the events leading up to the Council of Constantinople and what went on there will take like 2 to 3 episodes. But as I said, this is really beyond the scope of this podcast, as it would be strictly discussing the relationship between the Eastern Imperial Government and the Western churches, with very little to do with the Copts. And that's really my whole point here. The three chapters controversy had nothing to do with the Copts or the Miaphysites. When Theodora was alive, you could see a scenario where the condemnation of those bishops served as a foundation for future unity. But once she died, the last link connecting the Miaphysites with the palace in Constantinople was cut. Condemning those bishops did nothing but alienate the Western churches, as the Miaphysites were never really part of the conversation. It is telling that in the very same time that Justinian was jumping through intellectual and theological hoops with the Western bishops to convince them that excommunicating these bishops did not undermine Chalcedon, his agents were trying to wipe the memory of Severus and hunt down Jacob Boradius for arrest and execution, a fate similar to that of John of Tilla. And Jacob, in turn, became more convinced about the need of two different churches to save the Miaphysite Orthodoxy. During this time, he ordained something like 100,000 clergy, if we were to take the primary sources at face value, and that's really a big if. And Jacob was not the only one working. One of the Egyptian bishops at this time, named John, also traveled extensively, ordaining clergy and forming a permanent Miaphysite hierarchy. There is a nice historical snippet about John, where he ordained some 70 priests in one night in Ephesus. He too came really close to arrest and probably execution, and eventually went back to Egypt and settled there after his close call. With the Chalcedonians busy fighting among themselves, and Jacob running around everywhere ordaining clergy, Pope Theodosius was essentially locked away in a gilded cage in Constantinople. Respected and well treated, but with some serious limitation in what he could and could not do. When Theodora died, he prayed her funeral and gave a sermon that basically laid down the foundation of the relationship between the Miaphysite Church and the Emperor. He stressed the loyalty of the Church to the Emperor and the Empire as the agents of God to govern his children. If they hold the wrong theology, then the response is to pray for their return, not ideologically or via more practical means, resist them. He was also seriously conflicted about Jacob's mass ordination, and it really showed when he was choosing a successor to follow him. But we will get there next week. For now, despite his limitations, he managed to keep a relative check on some of the more extreme ideas going around in the Miaphysite camp. Ideas that would have otherwise died pretty quickly if it was not for his gilded cage limiting his activity. The most influential of these fringe groups were the Julianists, who we already discussed. The second was a group named the Triseists, who, as their name implies, took the 1 versus 2 natures argument of Christ and applied it to the Trinity, in essence creating 3 one-natured gods. This group had really nothing going on for them, but a powerful political patronage from a certain Athanasius, the grandson of the Empress Eudora. Their ideas did not have a popular appeal. Their intellectual argument was just a recycled version of pre-Nicene ideas and of Proto-Arianism. And they were absolutely despised by Theodosius, who at least nominally was still the leader of the Miaphysites. Eventually, after a considerable effort from Pope Theodosius and his secretary, Paul, the Triseists faded into the background, and it is at this point he started thinking about a successor, and his complicated feelings about Jacob came to the forefront. This brings us to the last few years of his life, and by good chance, Justinian, as the two men will die within a year of each other. In those last years, the series of disasters in the empire just continued. The Samaritan in Judea rebelled. Another famine occurred. The famine caused bread shortages in the capital, which in turn caused riots. By 557 AD, a serious earthquake hit the capital, and the dome of the Hagia Sophia collapsed. It seemed that the harder Justinian tried to earn God's favor, the more disasters hit the empire, which in turn made him even more determined to seek that favor. The Samaritan revolt was crushed. The Hagia Sophia was rebuilt. Extreme financial measures were undertaken to keep the empire afloat. At 81, Justinian's piety led him to leave the capital for a tough pilgrimage to a church where the tunic of Christ was present. At 82, about a year before his death, he took his most extreme and controversial theological position in his Lengthy reign, that in essence was the complete opposite for everything that he stood for. Justinian's latest and last religious policy was none other than the extreme Miaphysite doctrine of Julian, the arch-nemesis of Severus. It was quite something, as he went about enforcing it with the same zeal as he went about enforcing his anti-Miaphysite edicts a few decades earlier, and really all of his religious policies. The Chalcedonian Patriarch of Constantinople was removed, and the Antiochian bishop was about to be removed as well, but Justinian died before fully completing his last change of heart. The legacy of Justinian is a hotly debated thing. The ancient historians witnessing his reign were to a man extremely hostile to him, and it really didn't matter what was the religious views. The most famous of those historians, Procopius, actually was trying to convince his readers that Justinian was an actual demon taking the shape of a human. On the other hand, he is venerated as a saint in the Byzantine Orthodox Church. More recent assessment of his reign, as you would expect, are more nuanced. The war in Italy was a mess because his generals did not follow directions. Persia was a civilized place expected to adhere to peace treaties. The Chalcedon issues were a multi-layered and no one really could solve them, and more along these lines. I will let you make your own mind about him, but for the record, in the traditional Coptic histories, he was vilified as a tyrant who persecuted the church. My personal favorite take on him, though, comes from a poetic translation of Dante's Divine Comedy, where, in it, Justinian is ultimately in paradise, more for the efforts than the actual results, and with some nuanced revelations. Here it is. Caesar I was, Justinian I am, by the will of the first love, which I now feel. I pruned the law of waste, excess, and shame. Before my work, absorbed my whole intent. I knew Christ in one nature only, not two. And so believing, I was well content. But Agathos, blessed of the Lord, he, the supreme shepherd, pure in face, showed me the true way by his holy word. Him I believed, and in my present view, I see the truth as clearly as you see. How a contradiction is both false and true. As soon as I came to walk in the true faith way, God's grace moved all of my heart to my great work, and to it I gave myself without delay. Thank you for listening. Farewell, and until next week.